All right, we are back for another year of Dakar Rally Daily. This is Jesse Ziegler, and that's Quinn Cody right over there in studio at the Cycle News Studios. A couple big announcements right away. First, Climb Technical Riding Gear. The boys in Idaho are back on board, title sponsor of the Climb Dakar Rally Daily Show. So very big props to those guys. They're producing awesome product up there that I've abused the crap out of this year. I mean, I raced all the hard enduro races this year on one pair of pants.
One pair of pants.
Which is not easy.
Didn't even wash them.
Not easy for me because I crash a lot at hard enduro.
Yeah,
you do. Those pants are beat up. There's awesome. A phone outline in the pocket, but the pocket is still intact.
We love Climb.
Yeah, they're doing a good job and they're helping us out. So thank you, Climb. The second non-hesitant committed sponsor straight up just said, hey, interested in doing this again? Rally Navigator.
Yeah.
The best rally navigation tool anybody in the world is using to A, learn how to race rally, and B, get experience at making road books and playing with road books. And I know you have a ton of experience. Yep.
Yeah. So the Rally Navigator program has really just kind of upped the game for rally. You know, all the top guys are using it for training.
Yeah.
They're building road books themselves. The teams are building road books with Rally Navigator. And it gives you a true Dakar-like experience. They have all the same lexicon, everything that the symbols, the notations, and everything that is in a Dakar roadbook is available on Rally Navigator.
You can use it just for, if you're not going to build a rally route, you can do it just for a off-road route with your friends because it'll give you GPS log track that you can follow on GPSs. It'll really output a lot of tools. Plus the mapping tools are amazing.
You can set waypoints. You can do all kinds of stuff. I built a lot of my routes. You know, I built all the KTM Adventure Rider Rally routes with Rally Navigator and cause it's the quickest, fastest, most intuitive tool for making GPS tracks.
Right.
And you just do it over Google Earth and you get as close as you can and just kind of click away and it works really smooth.
Yeah, it's really bug-free. Works awesome on a computer. Desktop version is really cool now.
Yeah, they just launched their 2.0 version, which is a desktop version. So the previous ones have been all online and now we're able to do it on desktop and it works really smooth.
Yeah, very cool stuff. So shout out to Mike at Rally Navigator for coming on board again.
This is the time of year we start asking for sponsors. It's usually the day after Christmas.
Yeah, it's right after Christmas.
Typical style of our program here. But you know, we're getting our sponsors on board, and we're doing this thing.
This is an experiment every year.
And we've got another experiment we're trying because
why not?
Podcast wasn't enough.
Why not add another experience? Experiment and an experience at the same time. So proud to announce this year we have the Dakar Fantasy Derby experience live right now through Dakar Rally Daily, brought to you by our sponsors and our buddy Radek over at Chainslayer. So you can go to chainslayer.com/Dakar. That'll get you to a registration page. You hit register, put in your name, your email address. You'll have to confirm that so we know you're not a robot. And then you'll be able to compete with like-minded nerds like yourself and me and Quinn. You get to pick every day's finish, who you think is going to finish in which position, and you get to wage fake money that we give you against those positions. So let's say you want to pick Daniel Sanders to win the prologue, which is a great idea.
Yeah.
You could put all your money on Daniel Sanders to win, or you can spread it out to the top 10, all your money, or you can spread it out to the top 120. Whatever you want to do, whatever strategy you want to take into this, you can use that here in this fantasy world and try to beat us.
Yep. And you know, you get basically, you're rewarded by accuracy. So
right.
if you pick Ricky Brabec to win the prologue and he wins the prologue, you get 10 times your money.
Yep. Fake
and
money.
And if you get another, say you get Toby Price in second, oof, you get it. I don't know how it compounds. I'd have to look close, but basically your money goes nuts if you get the top three dead on.
If you get the top three dead on, you're going to get 10 times your bet on each one of those guys.
Yep. So
it's going to be big money. You're going to be winning.
It's kind of exciting. We did a couple of test runs and we were playing with it and it got my heart going. I was like, you know, when you throw down like $100 on red on the roulette table, it's kind of the same thing.
Even though
it's not your money.
Even though it's fake money, I still got just dumbly confident again that my picks were right. And that's never worked out for me. If you've listened to this show, you know I'm not good at picking these things.
No, this is something we've done the last couple of years, and now we talked about it last year after the rally. We were like, man, we should do a fantasy league. This would be cool, get everybody kind of in on this. And
yeah,
and we're able to pull it off with the help of our buddy Radek. He built this thing in, I don't know, a week.
Maybe. And yeah,
now he's been working on it for a while, but it's pretty impressive what he's put together. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun for everybody. It's 100% free. So you can go to the bivouacrally.com. So www.bivouacrally.com, and then click Dakar Fantasy, or you can go to chainslayer.com/Dakar. Either one of those will get you there. You got to register. It's 100% free. And we're going to be giving away some cool prizes to our daily winners.
Yeah.
So each day we're going to have a different winner, maybe not a different winner, but we're going to have a winner every day, whoever gets the most money.
Exactly. So sign up, play around with it, hit us up with questions. We'll give you fake answers because we don't have any real answers, but it's going to be fun. It works, and it's going to keep everybody engaged with this race that is incredibly engaging.
And it's 15 days of playing. So you got to play, you don't have to play, but you get to play 15 days straight.
Yeah, you're going to want to play because the year-end prizes are going to be big. We're getting big gift cards from the guys at Climb. I think we got some headlights coming in.
I think Moto-Minded is going to help us out with some headlights. And
Moto-Minded's coming together. We got some more gift cards and other things piling on from people, so we'll announce more of those as soon as we can. Speaking of announcements, we've already released our pre-show with our in-studio guest, Ricky Brabeck from the Monster Energy Honda Factory Racing Rally Team. If you missed that, go back, check it out. It's really entertaining. Ricky is unfiltered with a capital UN.
It's our boy, Ricky.
Yeah.
There's a reason we called him in to co-host with us.
He laid down his Ricky wisdom, and it was great. And he's got a lot of really good insight about the race rules and how it actually works out there on the ground. So what better way to talk about all the new stuff coming up this year than have Ricky just blurt it out for us? So that's a great show. It's live now. But on top of that, we have some interviews in the bank. Then we're going to start launching those right now. That's why you're here. We have Toby Price up first. Toby Price is
two-time
freaking legend.
Dakar champion. I think he's finished on the podium just about every time he's gotten on the motorcycle. He's either DNF'd or finished. And, it was really, really cool to get some insight from Toby. We were up in Barstow doing some training a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, and we were able to sit down in the hotel and have a chat with Toby. So he has some good stuff.
Yep. So check out Toby's thing and stay tuned for, we got Mason Klein coming up next, and then probably Skyler as well.
Yep.
All right. Stay tuned. Here's Toby. All right. We're back with our second guest, or maybe our first. We don't know which order we're going to put these in.
Yeah, probably.
Well, we're probably going to put this guy first.
Yeah.
This is the hotel tapes. From pre-Dakar hotel confessionals, we have the man Toby Price here in lovely scenic Barstow, California. We're at the hotel right off the freeway. 15 truck traffic's roaring by his window every night as he tries to get some sleep. What are you doing out here? Are you just riding around for fun and checking out the scenes in Barstow or what?
Look, we've been out here in Barstow now for this past 12 months a few times now, so we're just out here trying to get some different terrain, a lot more testing on the bikes, and from the past couple of years we've definitely had some issues and dramas with the bike that we've always just ended up testing in Morocco, so we've opened our horizons a little bit more and starting to look at some different areas to start to get some more feedback from the bike a little bit. So yeah, we're just out here also with Mason, riding around doing some road books for the next 5 days, and we have the weekend off. Well, actually, we've got the Kurt Casilli ride on the Saturday there.
Yep.
And then the rest of the team will come back next week and we'll do some more testing out here, but I think we're going to probably head down Sonora way. So yeah, it's going to be a part of the World Championship next year, so kind of good to get our foot in the door there a little bit and start to get some bit of a bit of background on what's there. So yeah, it's keeping us busy, and yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
A lot of travel for you being Australian and bouncing around all over the world, but like North America's getting a lot more attention in the rally world these days ever since these guys started training and winning.
What tell us what do you prefer,
doing road book training and testing in Morocco or in California? Let's
That's a very, very easy question to answer. That's definitely USA. look, it's there is some great training and great areas to ride in Morocco, but the lifestyle is just a little bit different. I tend to seem like I get a lot really sick on the food over in Morocco, so it's nice to come here to the States. Everything's just a little bit more upbeat, and like probably for like the past 20 years, majority of the guys that are on the team, they've actually been a part of the team for the 20 years, and all they've ever known is just to go and test in Morocco, and that was it. So every time, like, I'm pretty certain, like, about 80 to 90% of the team, as soon as you say, oh, yeah, we're going to Morocco to do this test, everyone's faces just, like, hit the floor and just drop. So not that it's, like I say, the riding and the terrain there is really good, but just, that living side of things, it just it can catch you out. I've been really sick there once that it actually took me out of one of the World Championship rounds, and I don't think I've ever been so sick in my life. So if it gets a hold of you, it definitely takes you down. So, it's just good. It's just, like, it's nice to see the team kind of lift that energy a little bit and something new and something different for them, and they can get on a plane and kind of be excited that they don't really have too many other things to stress about other than riding the bike and doing all the road books and just trying to look after us and get through the testing out here. So it's always just something new for them, and we're looking forward to getting down to Sonora and see what it's like there.
You guys are putting in some pretty big rally days. I know Quinn's ridden a bunch of the road books with Jordy Villadomes, who's been putting in some time building road books out here. You're doing miles and miles and miles and miles and miles a week. How many miles are you gonna do this week? It's 5 days.
I think we're already at like a bit over 400 miles.
2 days.
In 2 days. I think we're about 440 or 450 miles at the moment. So, we're just trying to spend as much time as we can on the bike. And actually, for me, it's pretty much my first ride back from Morocco when I crashed there and knocked myself out. Had a pretty good hit to the head and at 25 G's, and then I tore some ligaments in my thumb and everything, so I had a surgery on that. So, it's basically this week for me is just trying to get back on the bike and get comfortable again and just make sure that, the thumb's working and operating well. And
that's crazy. It's almost the first week of December.
Yep.
You know, the rally's going to start in 30 days.
Yep.
And Toby's first ride back on the bike was basically 2 days ago.
Yeah, 100%.
I think this is nothing new for him, though, right? I feel like...
Oh, man, if I could get into a Dakar uninjured and, like, not hurting in any way, that's a lotto win to me. So it's... I just seem to always have something just leading up to a Dakar that just kind of, like, trying to mask up a little bit. But it's... that's just the rally sport and motorcycle sport in general, really. We're always hurt.
You've won the Dakar Rally with a really serious injury. So
yep. That's what I mean. I've got no complaints now. I've got nothing that can take me out of the sport. It's just like, well, if you could do it once, like, you could do it again. So
you've really set yourself up.
Yeah, poorly. I've set myself up for disaster for the rest of my life, pretty much, but... I do not recommend doing that ever again. My wrist still doesn't work properly from it, but I've got that second trophy in my house, so I'll keep that any day of the week.
Yeah, two wins, correct? Yep. And this will be your ninth rally. We talked about that before the show. I didn't know that off the top of my head. Don't think I'm that smart. This is ninth race, rolling out to Dakar. That's an impressive career, obviously.
Yeah,
a couple wins and knocking on the 10th race is pretty epic. Are you looking ahead after this race or after next season for, the 10th and the 11th race, or are you keeping your options open and trying to figure out what's going to happen next?
Yeah, look, I'm definitely keeping the options open at the moment. At this stage, my contract does come up for renewal in March. So like we always say, it's all based off what the result at Dakar really is. It would be nice to sign off on another win, but then again, it's like anything. After I won my second one, I was like, oh yeah, that'll be enough for me. That's all pretty good. And then like 2 months after the race, there's that hunger and that burn and that desire comes back again, and you're just like, I'll go for one more, I'll see how we go. And then it's just, it you never can complacent, never happy with like kind of what you got. So it, not that if yeah you win the third one it's going to change the world completely, but it just, I don't know, you're never happy with what you got. So
you really want it.
Yeah, you just want it again, and it's,
you're addicted.
100%. Yeah.
So you won in 16, and the other one was
19.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, it's 2015 was my first attempt, and then we ended up with a third place there. 16 was a win. That was when I just signed with the Red Bull KTM factory team. Mm-hmm. 17 was a broken femur. 18 was a third place. After that, I had a rod that was in my leg from Bolivia, and don't recommend getting a femur fixed up in Bolivia, and that was a bit of a disaster that whole year. So then basically, yeah, the 18 result was basically, I was only on the bike probably 2 months before that race kicked off.
Yeah.
And yeah, got a third there. 2019, yeah, it was a year I raced with a broken scaphoid.
One with one arm.
And one with an arm, one arm.
Broken wrist.
Yeah.
Starts the race with a broken wrist.
And Toby Price can win with one arm.
Yeah, that's probably been the worst thing that ever happened in my life, really. It's nice to have that second win, but it's, yeah, that one never plays out well for us. So it's, yeah, everyone's pretty much just used to me being injured coming into a race. So it's, yeah, 19 was a good finish off on that one. 20... One, actually, I can't even think, that might have been a third place finish there as well. And then 22, yeah, was pretty much my worst result that I've had in a Dakar. So it's, yeah, it was a tough one to swallow. Day one just kind of killed us for that. But, yeah, we kept going till the finish just to see what would really happen. And, yeah, walked away with that. That was the first time I'd actually finished a Dakar, not on a podium. Right. At the finish line. So it was yeah, bit of a crazy one to take in. And so yeah, 23, there's a definitely a bit of pressure on, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're ready to get it back. It's crazy that last year's first, you know, few kilometers of the race, or however, I don't even remember how far in it got, that it got so crazy for people, and people are just dropping time, that could happen again this year. It could happen to the competition, you know, hopefully it doesn't happen to you again, but that's the nature of the sport going into it. You don't really know what's going to happen. And we were talking before the show, like, you didn't really know how to race rally when you went to Dakar and did your first rally. Like,
yep.
You had some opportunities to come out here and try some riding and do some road books, but you got there and you're like, I'm just going to go pretty fast and see how it works out. And you ended up getting third.
Yeah, no, that's it. Exactly. We were saying that earlier. Quinn took us out for a couple of road books there before, and yeah, I don't know if it was a good idea. It definitely it shot my confidence pretty good. I was just going the wrong direction all day long. And, yeah, basically signed up for the first one in, yeah, 2015. And basically, yeah, just didn't know what was going to come from it. And, yeah, we, yeah, Quinn was saying that, yeah, basically he was sending me out to a war zone, basically, and sending me out into disaster. And he's like, oh, well, probably never see that bloke again. And,
yeah, good luck, little buddy.
Yeah, good luck, and enjoy and have fun. And it was kind of crazy coming away with third place that one.
I felt bad for him, to be honest, because, you know, I took him out on some training road books, and it was pretty complicated. And Toby came in with some confidence after finishing Morocco, you know, not a month or so before. And whatever confidence he had from Morocco was completely erased, and he was just rattled.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh man, maybe I should have just like not done anything.
Which road books will do that.
But he ended up getting third. So
yeah, why didn't you give me the easy road books? Yeah. Might have been a win then. Jeez.
Yeah. Could have came out and won. Well, it's been an epic career. And I know you've taken that success in that career and sort of like parlayed it into other things you're passionate about and motorsports in general. We're talking trucks, we're talking machine shops and building parts back home. Tell me what your passions outside of rally are that you're really into now. And we're not going to talk about Baja 1000 this year. We all, if you're following him on social media, which you definitely should, Toby Price, his team just had like the worst luck ever, truck burned down, but we're not going to talk about that. Everybody's safe. That's all that matters. But what are you into 100%. Now that's not having trucks catch on fire in Mexico?
Look, honestly, everything just revolves around racing. Yeah. anything that's just got wheels and engines, I'm all for it. So it's the truck side of things, that basically came from my dad's side when I was growing up. Basically, when I was born, just before I could even start riding bikes, Dad used to race off-road trucks back home in Australia. And at that age, at like 3-4 years of age, I couldn't reach the pedals and steer a car or anything. So my next option was around the farm riding a bike. And basically from there, my dad sold the race truck, and that kind of funded us for a year or two, taking us around to some events and some racing. And then won some races and just basically took off from there. And I like anything, really. I love being in my shop, love building parts, and just trying to come up with new ideas and little things that are going to help, like on the bike or in the truck or anything that I do, really. So it's just trying to build a bit of a thing up there and just have a little bit of fun and just enjoy being around motorsport, really.
That's epic. Yeah. Building parts is cool.
Yep. Nice shiny bits. It was nice and cool. I love billet parts, so it's I've got a nice little CNC machine there that I'm trying to work out at the moment. But if anyone's got any ideas of things, definitely reach out, let us know. And I thought it was just basically think of a part, draw it, and then just press the green button on the machine, and it ain't nothing like that. So
it's more complicated.
Way more complicated than that. So it's it's good. It's always something to basically take your mind off riding bikes and take your mind off driving trucks, and then you can just, but you're still thinking about motorcycle things or car things, but it's just something completely different. Like, I'm hopeless. I can barely turn a laptop on, and I'm trying to run this CNC machine. But we're just having fun with it and enjoying things and having a bit of a bit of a laugh along the way with it.
So you mentioned the Caselli Ride Day is coming up this Saturday. So it's in a few days from this week. Your career on rally just coincides with Kurt 100%. I mean, I think he was a big factor in getting your or KTM's attention on you to race rally in the beginning. Can you talk about maybe some Kurt Caselli history to give everybody a little bit of history about your connection with him?
Yeah, so the connection with Kurt, it basically kind of kicked off around 2010, 2011, when we're at the ISDE, the 6-day enduro.
Yep.
Always ran into Kurt there pretty much once a year. And then basically at that point, I was still back home. We're doing an event called the Fink Desert Race and Hadar Desert Race. And Kurt always just kept an eye on the things I was doing there, and loved watching the Fink race. It was always reaching out every now and then to see if one year he could come over and have a go of it. And then I think it was the 2012 Baja 1000. It was probably about a month, 2 months out from the event kicking off. And I had a USA number call, and it was Kurt ringing then to say, hey, do you want to come over and be like a support rider for the Baja 1000? We've already got our riders all lined up and sorted, but we need a support rider. And I just thought it was one of my mates doing a prank, some stupid, crazy thing. I'm like, I don't think Kurt would be ringing me at this time and trying to get me to go to the 1000. And I came over that year and supported. So basically just flew around in the helicopter, and if I was needed, would jump on the bike and go from there. And you were on that year, weren't you?
I was on
the
team that year. And I met Toby in, I think, Mulahay.
Yep.
We were down there, and Toby's like, I forget how it came up, but we looked at his rear tire on his bike, and he's like, yeah, you know, you just 10 kilometers and all the knobbies just come off. They just come off the tire, just like that. Because you're holding the thing wide open. You're supposed to be pre-running, Toby.
You're supposed to be pre-running and like looking after things, and I'm just wanting to go flat out. So it was, I guess that's kind of like where we were in the KTM factory at that time over here in the States, and I'd never really done any navigational style of riding or anything. And Kurt and the boys basically just said, oh, here's a Garmin, it's got the track loaded in it,
follow it.
Basically just follow along that, and that's the race course you need to do. From that year was a peninsula run, so I had to go all the way from Ensenada down to La Paz.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the boys basically gave me a Garmin little GPS and said, yep, just follow that, you'll be sweet. And here's your van and the chase crew, and go and have a look at the track. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point in time too, then I think the boys were like, oh, well, we'll probably never see him again. Never, he's in Mexico and never lost. Be found, and he'll get lost down there on the track. And but yeah, I made my way down all the way to the bottom. Yes, all the boys, they were doing all their sections, and that kind of along the way would meet up along the track. And then I saw Kurt was doing the bottom section of the course that year. And basically I spent another day down there, went and jumped in with him and followed his section and seen where his lines and that were, and just wanted to have a ride with Kurt that time. And I can't remember the result that year. I think it was,
so yeah, that I broke my femur that year in the middle of the night.
That's right, it was too. But then
way down in Baja, and yeah, I think we ended up finishing second that year after broken femur. And might have had a local Mexican get on the bike and ride it for a few miles.
Yeah,
hand it off
to Kurt.
That's right, it was too. Yeah,
yeah. So yeah, that was that was another,
take it that way.
Yeah, I was actually like kind of, I was on the road in a chase vehicle, like, and I was a little bit further ahead of the bike. And then, well, I think we were nearly at that point, about to turn around and come back. And they basically rang us back and said, don't worry about it.
The bike just showed up.
The bike's here now, and Kurt's got it. So turn around, keep heading that
way. Don't worry about Quinn. So, he's fine. He's in the hospital somewhere.
I'm
on my way to the hospital. It's only 4 hours in the car.
He's behind us. We're going forward.
4 hours in with a broken femur. The back of a truck. 20. So it's not good, but... Yeah, so then basically from there, Kurt organized. Then I was starting to try out and do the Baja races for 2013.
Yep.
And I came over and raced the San Felipe 250. Yeah. And then that was with, I was teamed up with Mike Brown at that time. And my section there went fairly decent, pretty well. I think me and, Mike Brown ended up finishing fourth at that one. Kurt and Ivan won the San Felipe 250.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back over probably 3 weeks earlier to the Baja 500. And when I arrived, there was a Hare and Hound event on. Yep. And so I was like basically just trying to open my horizons to see what other championships I could do if I was going to come here full time and do Baja races. And yeah, that was the one that kind of changed everything for us pretty desperately. And I ended up breaking my neck there and having a helicopter flight out. Then I had to fly back home to Australia with a broken neck and have a surgery back there. So yeah, it was that was a bit of a rough one. And then what was it? And then the 2013 Baja, I was basically I only wanted to come over and just
support,
see the guys and support, help out. And then that's when unfortunately Kurt passed away in the race. So it was we got to ride with him probably a day and a half, 2 days before it all happened. And then from there basically I got the connection with Alex Doringer, and that's basically then what kind of kicked off all the Dakar talks and everything then in 2014.
It's wild how a simple connection with somebody you meet at a race at an ISDE somewhere can lead to so much stuff. Some of it obviously tragic, you know, for yourself and obviously for Kurt's and I don't know, just I'm always freaked out about the small connections in life that just take you down this road that you wouldn't have done before. Like for sure you wouldn't be sitting here. You wouldn't be, I mean, you might be sitting in Barstow, but maybe not talking about winning two Dakar rallies.
Look, I'm sitting here now loving life. So it's,
we might not be talking about having two, you know, Dakar Rally overall wins on the mantle at home.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's the journey along the way of meeting different people, and it's crazy to sit back like in 2010 and look at where we are now. It's like all these small little connections along the way. It's kind of paved its way to what it is now, and it's you look back then, you never picture it like this. That's for sure. So it's. Yeah, pretty surreal sometimes. Yeah, you definitely got to pinch yourself and just see it, if it's really actually all happening or if it's a dream sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Speaking of differences, the race back then, the Dakar race specifically, was considerably different than, you know, it was all South America, wide open on pretty much straight roads a lot of the time. Then you know, they get to Saudi Arabia, they start mixing things up with more navigation. And now, like, the rule game is just like being thrown at you guys like crazy. Like, you are the classic example of a rule biting people in the ass with the one tire through the thing and the massive zip ties and the bush mechanic skills coming out. And, you know, it's interesting, like, from your perspective, is any of that stuff that they're trying to do to slow it down, make it safer? A, is it making it any safer? Or do you think that's just smoke and mirrors? And, like, what's coming next that you're, that's on your radar as far as, like, new rules and regulations?
Yeah, look, it's a hard subject because I'd hate to be in that position to try and make these calls to try and make the sport safer. Like, it's end of the day, the manufacturers and companies are investing more and more money to make these bikes better, lighter, stronger. So it is kind of a hard thing to keep up to. Look, I think that the most frustrating part is it's every race you come to, there's a new rule change or there's something you haven't been able to train for or get your head wrapped around a little bit. And the validation waypoints and stuff like that, 1 minute they're 200 meter radius, next in there 300 meter radiuses, and then next minute it's 90 meter radiuses, and it's just like, come on guys, like, we need to get into a normal rhythm so we can train like this all the time and just get our head wrapped around what's kind of going on and what's happening. So yeah, like this year they're implementing a few new rules. So we have a top speed limit now, which is 160 kilometers an hour. The bikes will do probably 180, 185 kilometers an hour. So whether you crash at 160 or 180, you're virtually going to get the same outcome. Like, it's not really going to, it's going to hurt at 160. Yeah. It's going to hurt a little bit more at 180. Like, it's not going to be much of an outcome difference. So
for the Americans that are listening, you know, that's crashing at 100 mile an hour versus 109 miles an hour or something. So yeah, that 9 mile an hour,
isn't going to save nothing. So it's little things like that. Like, I agree with them trying to make the sport safer for sure. But I think the only way to make the sport safer is by, I'm not saying that they're not putting that work and effort into making road books, but that's the only way they're going to slow us down, is by making the road books not more complicated, but just planning the road books a little bit better. So it's like, at the moment they put us on a 30 kilometer stretch, which is like, what, in miles? I don't know.
It's like, it's like, I mean, 20 miles.
20 miles straight line.
20 miles straight line and wide open, full gas.
Yeah.
And you're just like, well, it's kind of boring. Like, you could have put us up in the mountains here, or you could have slowed us right down, which is then what we're, the ultimate goal of us trying to slow us down. But at the moment, they're just putting us on the 20, 30, 40 mile straight stretches and just wide open, full gas. And it's like, well, that's probably why the most of the injuries are kind of happening, is because it's just, you're not, so it doesn't seem like they're putting the effort into the road book.
Lose a little focus even too when you're going.
Yeah, the route and the terrain that you're on, you know, rather than throwing in some turns and not, you know, not long straights or, you know, winding stuff through different valleys and.
Yeah, 100%. And that's like, we have a lot of riverbeds and stuff like that. It's like stones can just pop out of nowhere. And it's like, when you don't go through and pre-run the course and know every single inch of the racetrack, they're trying to put us into these riverbeds that sometimes you're coming from 160 kilometers an hour, 100 mile an hour, and
jumping
then
into a
jumping into a riverbed, and it's like, you could have, like there is dangers and like double dangers and triple dangers and stuff like that and warnings, but
you're relying on the person who makes that to keep you safe at that point.
100%. You're just trying to, you're basically just giving your life into somebody else's hands, hoping that they done the roadbook properly and gave you a good, complicated roadbook, but not something too much that we can't understand.
Not that everybody's getting lost and losing time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a difficult subject.
Tough balance, like, right? Like, they have to get the whole race bivouac and logistical freaking complicated city from this city to this city, and they got to get the race course there. There's going to be stretches that they got to go fast and straight. And
so
terrain can't always go where we want it to, probably, either. So
100%.
It's not an easy solution. There's no easy solution, right?
In the last, say, you know, since you started Rally eight, 9 years ago, how much have the road books changed, and how different is it from 2016, 2015 yeah. to now is...
Yeah, it's a massive big difference now. So it's like now we don't get the road books until 20 minutes before the stage.
Yep.
They're basically just hand it to you. You're putting it into the bike pretty much as quickly as you can, because 20 minutes seems like a long time, but then when you get a road book that's spread for probably 80, 90 meters
yeah.
across the like the parking lot.
It'll take 10 minutes to roll that thing up.
It'll take 10 minutes to roll that thing into there. So yeah. it's then you've only got 10 minutes basically to try and get organized and have your power bar or gel or
make sure you put your freaking jacket on before you take off.
Yeah, zip up and do everything you need to do. And
I'd forget my goggles. I'd be like, let's go.
Put them on upside down.
Yeah.
That's even better. So, yeah, like from 2015, they've changed. Honestly, I've lost count of how many times they've had rule changes. So it's, I'm like, still kind of like stuck in the 2015-16 style yep. era of road books. And one benefit we did get was basically when you do get the road books the morning of the stage, mm-hmm. You don't spend that 3-4 hours marking and highlighting the road
books. The night before, right? Yeah, so you're getting some sleep.
Yeah, you get a little bit more rest, a little bit more sleep, and just can get yourself ready for another day. But I kind of enjoyed doing the roadbooks and marking it the way I wanted to mark a roadbook. So at the moment, they've done a certain color code for the things in the roadbook,
right?
And everyone gets the same roadbook. So there's really no benefit, no difference.
Yeah. Took a part of the race out.
Yeah,
really, 100%. Like the cust, because people would. Yeah. Be able to decipher the road book and sort of, you know, almost predict where it's going to go in their head and like give themselves like a big red mark circle here. It means yep. hit the brakes.
Yep.
You can do your own.
You can start marking notes. Things and going, there's this section of the track looks like it's going to get quite like tight and technical.
Yeah, so I'll highlight this
so
whole thing.
So you kind of highlight
color.
This bit more. So you kind of like anticipate it coming up.
Cause you know, you're going to be telling yourself, hey idiot, look at this. Cause don't just, yep. pin it here. Yeah. Slow yeah. down.
Slow down a little bit, and you've got a huge, big yeah. red marker around the outside of these 5-6 boxes yeah. that are in the road book. So
all that's gone.
So that's all gone. So it's
everybody gets the same book, and now they're going to have AB books or 1-2 books or something like where there's different small different sections in the road book where you're not going to be on the same course as other people. It sounds
as
like.
Other people,
trying to prevent people from following tracks or getting, yeah. you know,
just throwing another wrench in, throwing another wrench in Toby's
wrench
machine.
Into the whole thing, and it's something we've never even tried or tested, and then we're going to the biggest race in the world
and expected to master it
on the day and at that time.
You might get a chance to test that next week. I don't know.
Inside information from Quinn's.
This will be perfect.
Road books.
Don't follow tracks.
To me, and I'm excited to see how this works out, because to me it just seems like just an opportunity for a cluster. Like when you come into the finish and you nailed it and they're like, yeah, you were 3 minutes down. You're like, how's that possible? Their course must be 3 minutes shorter than mine.
Yeah, 100%.
Like how can
yeah.
you make it the same distance
or,
in time?
Or what happens if there's a guy behind you and then when the course splits, all
he's
of a
in
sudden
front of
he's
you.
In front of you.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, how is that going to work? But that's why we're here, I guess, to see how it works.
We're about to find out in January. So.
But it is kind of crazy. Like top level motorsports athletes in the entire world, nonstop, like full stop there. Like there's nobody else that's on another level than Toby Price and his, you know, colleagues racing these motorcycles.
Yep.
They're going to have to do something maybe they haven't done before and master it to be the best in the world.
Yeah.
100%. No other sport would do that.
No, not on the,
not
the,
on the first
the
day of
the
race.
Kicking off, that's for sure. Like it's cycling, swimming, all that stuff or
no.
whatever it is.
It's not like a Formula One team. You'd be like, by the way.
Yeah. By the way.
Welcome to the first race of the season.
Yeah. There's a joker lane now.
Yeah.
So.
There's a lane and you got to figure out when you can use it. And there's a whole bunch of rules when you can't use it, but you'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out. Make it work. You'll be right.
Good luck.
Like, God damn it. What is this?
Good luck, Mercedes AMG.
So, and then, yeah, this year they've got like a bonus scheme structure or something that
yep.
they're planning on doing. And
trying to reward guys for winning stages.
Yep. Yeah, to try to stop that sandbagging, to get a position, bounce back and forth game. But that's the part of the race, right? Like
yeah,
strategery.
It's annoying when you're in that, as we were saying before, that yo-yo effect.
Yeah, right.
1 minute you're at the front, next minute you're at the back, next minute you're at the front.
Yeah,
it's just like, yeah, it's just like this yo-yo just going up and down, up and down. But it's, in some way, when you're in that effect, it's frustrating as anything.
Yeah.
When you're sitting there and sitting in the camper and like looking at the result going, looks terrible today. Tomorrow then it's at the top of the list and it's all good. And you're like,
trying
well,
not to get
I know
crazy about
what's
it.
Going to happen tomorrow. I'm going to be back down at the bottom of the list again. It's like, so that gets a little tiring, but it's if you can situate yourself into the middle of that part of it and just keep consistent, that's like usually the best spot and area to be.
Yeah.
So it's I don't know. I don't know how this bonus structure type thing's really going to work either. So that's another new thing they're throwing on us this year as well. So I'm not too sure on how if you win the last stage, you don't get a bonus or something. Like it's what. How does that all kind of work out and like what comes from it from winning the last stage?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's
up in the air.
It's for
I think
everyone.
they've tried to work out a few formulas and a few different ways of doing things, but they haven't really announced anything that's concrete yet.
And we're 38 days away from the race. So it's like perfect. We don't even know how this bonus structure is going to work just yet, but it's
guess we'll be taking this race day by day.
Yeah, that's all you can do when you're in that middle part of the, like you're right there in the thick of it. You can only take it day by day, and that's the thing. It's Dakar has pretty much already decided who's going to win the thing, but we don't know none of that, and you can't put all your eggs in one basket on one person because it can all change in the blink of an eyelid. So it's just. I guess that's what makes it so exciting, but when you're in the thick of it and all these rule changes and all these things going on, you're just like, just give us that one formula so we can train to suit that and then we can be then ready for the race. But at the moment, we're just, you're just kind of winging a little bit.
Experimental mode.
Yeah, 100%. But it's, in some ways too, it's still pretty exciting.
It's exciting to watch.
Yeah.
It's like the best thing in the world to be a fan of.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind experiencing it one year just to sit on the computer screen. Why the hell did you go that way? You're such an idiot. Why'd you do that? Like, it looks so easy
nice
on that
on
computer
this
screen when you're in the thick of it and just going.
I'm drinking coffee while you guys are coming into the finish line.
Yeah.
It's nice on
this
side of the world.
You just went straight up that mountain, and when you're there at the bottom of the hill and looking up and going, I don't even think the bike will make it up there. It's just like, you sound so stupid sometimes when you come in and go, well, this is what happened in my day, but.
Yeah.
To try and paint the picture for people, and it's just like, doesn't sound like it was that complicated, but it's like didn't ride the damn.
Yeah,
stuff.
You weren't sitting
out there looking at it. So it's a tough one, that's for sure.
Let's talk about the bike. Last year, KTM was very aggressive, brought brand new bike into the race. I mean, it was developed. I mean, you guys had it like 6 months before the rally or something like that out here. You were testing it. You guys were testing it in Morocco or somewhere as well, or Spain.
Yeah, so we've been developing.
Got to ride it.
We've been developing the bike now for probably close to two and a half years, roughly. Yeah. I would say. We came over here quickly and done a test with it. Everything seemed like it was all pretty good, but then the only way you're going to know is by throwing it into a race situation. Right. Went to Morocco and then kind of figured out. Yeah, we had a lot more work to do.
Right.
This past 12 months has been pretty strenuous for everyone. Like it's Quinn's been testing a lot of parts. The guys at the shop in Europe have been flat out nonstop. Riders have been testing so many different options and different things, and it's sometimes you just feel like you're just going in this bit of a vicious circle.
I bet.
You start the day and you're like, oh, okay, the bike's doing this, and then it's like. By the end of the day, you're like, I think it's working better. Like it's handling and it's got more power. And then they go, we'll put it back to the way it was when we first started the day. And then you jump on that setting and you go, shit, that actually feels pretty good.
That's actually
like,
better.
Did I just do a whole day for nothing? It's nice to have all these options, but sometimes you can find yourself going in that little bit of a spiral of just not. Picking up on what it is actually really doing. It does probably feel better, but you maybe know the track a little bit better. You're starting to anticipate things, and so we always like to try and do a day testing, try and get a setting that we feel is kind of right, and then it's like go and do a road book with it because that kind of simulates that unexpected, not knowing what's coming up, how the bike will handle that. Yeah. So it's a huge big part for it there. So the boys have been working flat out. Like I feel really bad for them at the shop because it's been a pretty strenuous year. And but I think now we're we're starting to get on top of what we really need for Dakar and in January, and have a pretty strong bike and a good chance for it. So it should be good.
Could come back and get another win, that bike.
It would be very nice. Yeah. Well, Sammy got a win on it on the new bike. So yeah, it's we still had a really good bike this year, and Sam won the race.
Yeah.
And you kind of look at it and go, well, what do we need to do? We don't need to do anything. Like, yeah, we're winning. The bike won.
We won. It's perfect.
But it's always
there was a little bit of drama last year between some guys wanting to ride the old bike, some guys wanting to ride the new bike.
Yeah, I can understand why.
You know, in the end, the new bike won. So
yeah. So you know, what do you say? Huh? You sit there and look at it and go, well, I can't really argue now. Like, you've got to ride the new bike. New bike's perfect. It won the Dakar Rally. Yeah,
can't get better than that.
Can't get better than that. So it's like, well, we still have some stuff to fix. Like, it's like nothing in life is ever perfect. So it's
KTM's way, though. Like, they're never like just like, cool, we won. Let's just cap that at our setting, and that's our rally bike, and that's what we'll give to everybody, and that's what they'll race. Like, that's not KTM's way. They're like, you know what we can do is like this little better, and look, we made this, and they just keep throwing it in.
I mean, there's always new rules coming at us. There's a speed limiter now, so it's like you have to figure out a way to get these guys to be able to control their speed at 100 miles per hour.
Yeah. And not go over 100, but not go under 100.
There's no real, clear way of doing that, right? You can't just tell the rider, hey, when you see your speedometer get to 99, slow down.
They're not looking at their speedometer. Looking at a road book. They're looking at terrain. They're looking at a lot of other
things. We've already got so many things to try and manage right now, and now they
have more buttons than this thing has.
You don't want to put a rev limiter on the bike or something that cuts the engine out. So there's, it's really tricky, and I mean they're coming up with solutions and testing this stuff, and they're half the team's here testing stuff, and the other half's back at home preparing the bikes and literally shipping them to Saudi Arabia this week.
Yeah. So it's on.
It's it would be quite a stressful time for the boys in at the shop at the moment. So it's we're just trying to fast track this stuff. Not in a way that it's not going to be reliable, but we need to make sure that it's going to work for January. So it's why it's kind of come down to the last minute a little bit, just to make sure we've got everything, all our things.
And it's
quite a bit.
And so, like, it's 12 months down the road from the last bike that raced too. So it must be better in general, in air quotes, better. I mean, that bike won the race, like we said, but still it's rushed. Even in 12 months, because that's not that long of a cycle to develop stuff, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like a lot of people think, looking from the outside, it's just like, if you need to try this part or if it's not available. Like, people just think you click your fingers and tomorrow morning.
Just push the green button
here
at the CNC machine.
Yeah, don't worry. That's what I'm starting to work out that process and going, maybe that I'll give the boys a month just to try and work that part out a little bit more. So, it kind of gives me a little bit more of a better understanding of how quick the turnaround time and process is on things like this. Because it's, everyone thinks, you're a factory rider.
That'd be so nice.
There's a truck full of parts of just unlimited access of just trying to try all these different spring rates and try all these different linkages and swing arms and all these things. It takes time to plan and process. And, it's definitely a... Definitely feels like sometimes it's rushed at the moment, especially when we're 38 odd days or something away from Dakar. But it's we're just trying to make sure we've got all our I's dotted and T's crossed, and just make sure that we're best prepared as we can be.
Quinn knows that process really well, at the R&D department here, and being involved with helping the rally team and stuff. But it's
It's complicated. It's not an easy thing. And to set up a rally bike, it's such a wide range of terrain that you cover, and
speed,
fuel level. You have,
insane durability standard. Like, this thing has to not have a failure.
Yeah, not only that,
from tire to handlebar, like, nothing can fail.
70 pounds of fuel on board when it's full, and then when it's empty, you're down, so the bike's 70 pounds lighter than when you started. Like, imagine that. People are putting in titanium bolts on their bike and thinking that they feel something.
30 grams.
And, we're talking 70 pounds.
Yeah.
That's another small person on the back.
To make a bike, need to be able to go 100 mile an hour across the desert and, 10 mile an hour through the technical rocky stuff. And it's such a wide range. And so there's always going to be a compromise between – your setup no matter what. And and you just have to find the compromise that works best for you as a rider. And
crazy,
you know.
No, 100%. That's it. That's the hardest part is, that fuel distribution is major. I always just try and drain the rear tank first because I find getting that all that extra weight off the rear shock, things start just to work a little better. But once you start draining that front tank, it turns the bike into basically from a soft lounge chair when you first get on it to then basically like you're about to line up at Anaheim 1 and on the Supercross track. And it's like huge, big difference. So it's very, very hard to try and get a good base setting. Like I say, we've got stones and rocks, and it's not like the road MotoGP and stuff where you've got a 2.3-kilometer course that basically never changes. It's only the track temperature that changes and basically the soft or hard or medium compound tire.
Yeah.
So it's I'm sure there's a lot of other things that I don't see behind the scenes that changes in that too. But yeah, when you go from sand dunes to rocks to hard pack to soft fesh and everything like that, it can change the bike completely. So it's a very, very difficult task that all manufacturers have on the hands just to try and make a bike work really well.
Not only are the athletes tasked with doing impossible things every day and like just coming up with new ways to get stuff done, but the bike has to deal with that too. It's just like both of you, it's like they just send you out there. Good luck, guys.
Yeah, pretty much.
Also, here's a whole heap of new rules that you got to learn too.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, no, it's
sounds bananas.
It's a very interesting sport sometimes. But
yeah, I love it.
I don't know. It keeps drawing you back for more of it. That's for sure.
Well, we're here for it. We're excited to watch, talk to you as much as we can. Keep your phone on. We're going to be annoying you after every stage.
Only talk to me on good days.
Before your booth. Well, every day's going to be a good day. I got a lot of confidence in you this year.
Perfect. I'm happy with that. So,
best of luck. Get some more miles in before that race.
Sounds like a plan. Not looking forward to it. Barstow's treating us well, and then see what the rest of the week will bring for next week. So
sweet.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having us.
All right.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Yo.